Cape Talk. Cape Talk. A world view from London with Adam Gilchrist.
Adam Gilchrist, a very, very good morning. I hope we have a clearer line. I enjoy talking to you. Particularly, I enjoy hearing from you. How are you doing today, sir?
Good morning. I think sometimes somebody stands on the line halfway up Africa or halfway down Europe or something. I think that's what happens. Just technologically speaking, of course.
There's a fish entangled in an undersea internet cable somewhere.
Let's blame that.
But let's start in Iran. Over the last few weeks, particularly via social media, I've been seeing the protests, the very visible, brave protests of particularly Iranian women, but also the intense, fierce and brutal police repression in Tehran and other parts of Iran. It's all regarding issues around hijabs. But currently, the Ayatollah is blaming external forces for the unrest.
Yes, a lot of this stemmed, I mean, of course, it's an ongoing issue. It's the wearing of headscarves, the wearing of the hijabs, but it stems from the death in custody of Mahsa Amini over 2 weeks ago now. And there have still been protests. Maybe they've been a little quieter. There have certainly been arrests as well. And you're right, the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has absolutely blamed the riots, as he called them, on outside forces. He said they had been engineered by Iran's archenemies and their allies. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. Of course it's not. Of course, there's also absolutely no evidence of it. But he has in particular pointed the finger at Israel and the United States. The US has said it was appalled by the violent response to the protests. Interestingly, in the UK, Iran's most senior diplomat was summoned and told, stop blaming external actors, take responsibility for the actions of the security forces, which is all very well coming from an outside nation. These days, Iran doesn't need the UK, it doesn't really need the United States, doesn't really need anyone. It's sanctioned up to the neck and is probably well fed up with all of that. But internally, as we look at it from abroad, you wonder how much of a shift this is going to be, how much of a culture shift this could end up being, or will it be like Tiananmen Square and everything will just eventually get cracked down and go away?
We go now to Paris now, where there's a lot of discussion around French support for Ukraine, or in other words, a lack thereof.
Exactly that. Yeah, France under pressure, certainly to provide more military aid for Ukraine. The French president has held meetings to that effect in Berlin. He met the German chancellor last night. Given that Emmanuel Macron has trumpeted France as a pillar of European defense, and in fact, you'd probably think, you know, who are the stalwarts of the EU defense force and to some extent NATO? You'd probably absolutely look to France and Germany, purely geographically. But in terms of the numbers, France is providing Ukraine with 2% of its weaponry from outside. So 98% is essentially coming from the United States, United Kingdom, Poland, Germany, Canada, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Estonia, Australia, and then France. All those, I mean, Australia, more vested in European defense than France. Even the Aussies are doing it. I don't know. It's concentrating a fair few minds in Paris. There are certainly some at the French Defense Ministry who are scratching their heads and thinking, yeah, it doesn't look good, does it? We are sort of sitting on our hands a little bit. Now, what would Napoleon do? Now, probably that's not the right question. He obviously would invade. But no,
he would invade in winter. That's what he would do.
Yes, without proper coats. That's what Napoleon would do. What Ukraine needs is a united Europe behind it, and it just feels like one or two countries aren't quite fully going the whole hog.
And finally, footsteps in the sand. Are you about to read a religious motivational poem?
No, you're all right. It's safe. Yes, if there's one thing we know about footprints on the beach, footsteps in the sand, is that they disappear. They are notoriously temporary. But of course, over time, if things change, if those footprints become essentially footprints in mud, and then the sort of primordial mud that lasts for thousands of years, it becomes extra interesting. So here we have, along the crumbling, muddy coastline of northwest England, around Formby in Lancashire, thousands of footprints have been exposed. Of course, weather conditions have changed a little bit over the summer, so that's what's made the difference. Mm. The oldest of these footprints, 7,000 BC, are the prints of aurochs, wolves, and lynx, and as it shifts forward in time to about 2000 to 1000 BC, the footprints increasingly are of human beings, deer, and dogs. Things changed. They're exact as well. They've absolutely loved. They've been poring over the footprint of a teenager. They've worked it out from the size. From 8,000 years ago, he had a bunion on his big toe, and they worked out he was probably a tailor. Although, could you really be a professional tailor 8,000 years ago? Apparently, they think maybe. It's been nicknamed the Irish Sea Serengeti because of the link with ancient life, just off Formby in Lancashire. One of the largest prehistoric finds on the planet. And here's the thing, Lester. Absolutely certain to be covered up by either new mud or washed over or washed away forever. It's still sort of temporary, really.
For some reason, it reminds you about Monty Python. There's fresh filth over here, and you go scrounging around in the mud. That's what I see.
I thought you were thinking of the big foot as well. With the it could have been one of those.
Adam Gilchrist joins us again tomorrow with The Worldview, all the way from London in the UK.